B. Collins, news and comment. It's Friday, August 7th, 2020. Your humble host has had a busy day dodging the vagaries of the coronavirus scene. I took my car in for routine service, and then they told me we don't have a shuttle right now because of the COVIDs. So I had a lovely walk each way from the shop to my secret studio, and then just got back from the dealership because they're now closing early. So that's my way of explaining that I'm getting to recording the podcast a little later than usual today. I hope that doesn't ruin anybody else's schedule. My bigger gripe, however, is our lead story today. And let me set this up by saying that I've known Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, for many years. And we've had personal conversations, interviews, and I have a generally high regard for him and his skills as a politician and as a guy who is running government. And overall, on the lockdown pandemic issues, I think he's done fairly well. The nursing homes, the prisons, not so well. And under the fog of COVID, I've just learned because of the great reporting by Steve Horn that Gavin Newsom had declared a moratorium on fracking. That much I knew. But the moratorium was lifted, and around the 4th of July, Chevron, one of the biggest multinational oil companies based here in California, got a special permit. A permit to operate a solar-powered fracking site. Now, just savor those words, okay? A solar-powered fracking site. Now, Gavin Newsom has a pretty good record on the environment. He's made the right noises about climate change, about the massive conversions that we need to go through. And when he declared the moratorium, I thought that he was doing better than Jerry Brown, his predecessor, who, while he grandstanded around AB 32 and the renewal of the cap-and-trade scheme, in the very same legislation, he gave a break to the state's diesel truck fleet, and he neutered regional air quality agencies, preventing them from conducting regulation that had been under their exclusive control. But I've linked to Steve's report at The Real News, and Steve, by the way, has agreed to tape an in-depth interview with yours truly on Monday, so we'll find out much more then. But the location of this oil field is near the town of Lost Hills. And Steve Horn, without referencing Chris Hedges, quotes an environmentalist, a person from Greenpeace, describing Lost Hills as a sacrifice zone. It's a small town, only 2,500 humans, but the community is 97% Latino, and 27% live below the poverty line. This fits the definition that Hedges gave us of a sacrifice zone. The air quality sucks. Toxic chemicals, including methane, acetone, dichlorofluoromethane. I may have missed a syllable there. And acetaldehydes. I honestly don't know what those are, but they sound pretty nasty. So this permit was granted just before the July 4th weekend, and it is a partnership between Chevron and the wonderful people, the global capitalist exploiters at Goldman Sachs. And they got the permit through the Innovative Crude Oil Applications Program that is administered by the California Air Resources Board. It's part of the Low Carbon Fuel Standard. And I see this as simply a matter of greenwashing, where Chevron has agreed to build a huge solar array adjacent to this fracking operation. And it's going to be green. because the energy didn't come from natural gas or nuclear, or we don't burn much coal here in California. We import a little bit of electricity that's generated from coal, but none of it is burned in the state. And the crude oil that is left in the ground here in California, where we've been pumping oil for 100 years, and still a full 40% of our gasoline comes from crude oil that was pumped out of the ground here in the Golden State. And the remaining crude is pretty nasty. It is not quite tar sands, but it's, without getting technical, because I'm not capable of that, it is a tar-like crude that requires highly energy-intensive techniques, resulting in a carbon footprint higher than that of Canadian tar sands. So this is inexplicable, and it is unacceptable. California positions itself, at least in the media, as a forward-looking state that's concerned about human impacts on climate, and the temperature rises that can fuel sea level rise, desertification. And this is a serious black mark on the record of Governor Gavin Newsom. So the intelligence community is at it again. If you remember 4 years ago in August, that was when John Brennan made a trip over to the White House to whisper in the ear of President Obama, the Russians are trying to meddle in the election. So now, 4 years later, a whole new team running the National Counterintelligence and Security Center, which is under the Director of National Intelligence, and the NCSC head is named William Evanina. So he's now warning us that China is trying to interfere in our election to defeat Trump, and Russia is trying to interfere in our election to defeat Biden. Now, will they be equal and cancel out? Is anything that this is claiming based on any actual evidence? Well, Evanina made a proclamation today, an announcement. China has been expanding its influence efforts ahead of the vote in November, pressuring political figures it sees as opposed to its interest and trying to deflect and counter criticism of China. Russia, which according to the Washington Post, they flatly declare this, which interfered in the 2016 election to help boost Trump's chances. You know, I don't see that as proven. Now wants to diminish former President and former Vice President Biden. And Evanina said, we assess that Russia is using a range of measures to primarily denigrate former Vice President Biden and what it sees as anti-Russia establishment. Here's a further quote from Evanina related to China. And notice he uses the word assess as the active verb here. That's the same weasel word that John Brennan and Jimmy Clapper relied on in their claims about Russian meddling in 2016. Quote, we assess that China prefers that President Trump, whom Beijing sees as unpredictable, does not win re-election. China has been expanding its influence efforts ahead of November 2020 to shape the policy environment in the United States, pressure political figures it views as opposed to China's interests, and deflect and counter criticism of China. Although China will continue to weigh the risks and benefits of aggressive action, its public rhetoric over the past few months has grown increasingly critical of the current administration's COVID-19 response, closure of China's Houston consulate, and actions on other issues. For example, it has harshly criticized the administration's statements and actions on Hong Kong, TikTok, the legal status of the South China Sea, and China's efforts to dominate the 5G market. Beijing recognizes that all of these efforts might affect the presidential race. Now, everything that they listed in this litany is completely understandable as a response to Trump's provocations. The trade war that's now just buried in the news. We never hear anything about those tariffs, the massive amounts that he says China is paying to the United States, when in fact it's American consumers who are paying those tariffs. The issue about the Houston consulate is based on the notion that Russia was paying bounties to Taliban fighters in Iran. And we'll get to an update on that story here down the stack in a minute or two. Okay, so now here is the full quote of the statement about Russia. "We assess," again the weasel word, "that Russia is using a range of measures to primarily denigrate former Vice President Biden and what it sees as an anti-Russian establishment. This is consistent with Moscow's public criticism of him when he was VP for his role in the Obama administration's policies on Ukraine and its support for the anti-Putin opposition inside Russia. For example, pro-Russia Ukrainian parliamentarian Andriy Derkach is spreading claims about corruption, including through publicizing leaked phone calls to undermine former Vice President Biden's candidacy and the Democratic Party. Some Kremlin-linked actors are also seeking to boost President Trump's candidacy on social media and Russian television." Okay. First of all, let's deal with the very last part, Russian television, even if that refers to RT, the American arm of Russian media. That's a joke. Then we talk about social media. 2016 was a joke. I hope if the Russians are actually using Facebook and Twitter, they've gotten better at it. And this linkage of Ukraine to Russian interests really gets back to the impeachment testimony of Fiona Hill, who said that the efforts to blame Ukraine for meddling in 2016 are a Russian propaganda operation. And Derkach is the guy who has released these heavily edited phone calls that are, you know, they're edited, but they include actual comments from Joe Biden saying that he wants the Ukrainian prosecutor fired and he's holding back $1 billion until that's done. Those are facts. Biden's bragged about it. And so these are issues that are in play domestically. And certainly Russia and China would have an interest in trying to leverage them for their own benefit. But we've been told, you know, that these outside agitators want to sow discord in the United States. And nobody sows discord in the United States than Americans, led by Trump. The way he has stoked the fires of racism in this country, ignored the plaintive calls of protesters following the death of George Floyd and many other cases, the way he paints all Black Lives Matter protesters and activists as looters and thugs and anarchists. That's not Russia. And our own media amplifies all this stuff to boost its own ratings. And you don't need RT to do that. But before I move on to the next story, there is another player. Iran. "We assess that Iran seeks to undermine U.S. democratic institutions, President Trump, and to divide the country in advance of the elections. Iran's efforts along these lines probably will focus on online influence, such as spreading disinformation on social media and recirculating anti-U.S. content. Tehran's motivation to conduct these activities is in part driven by a perception that Trump's re-election would result in a continuation of U.S. pressure on Iran and an effort to foment regime change." That's not a fucking perception. That is what Trump is all about. He is heavily influenced by Israel in the way he has isolated Iran. He pulled out of the nuclear agreement. And in a farcical manner, in September, we will go to the United Nations and say that while we walked away from that agreement, we want to continue to enforce one part of it, the arms embargo. And the incoherence of that position, the assassination of General Soleimani in Iraq. These are very provocative moves, and it is believed that Israel is responsible for the fires at the Natanz nuclear facility recently. But the U.S. may have had a role, or at least gave its approval to Israel. And so, our intelligence community is so screwed up. And for them to release this kind of an assessment, which will be played up by the media, we're all supposed to be cowering in the corner, holding our phones at arm's length because there could be an Iranian agent crawling right through your phone right now and you wouldn't even know it. Oh, boy. Okay. So, the Trump administration officially denies there was Russian interference in 2016. And as you know, while I don't support Trump or his administration, I think that that is generally accurate. Despite that, Mike Pompeo, who plays Secretary of State in this reality TV show, has authorized a huge communications effort to individual Russians. We are posting on websites at what one Russian described as a spam site. We are offering a bounty, $10 million for information on Russian interference in our election. So one of the people who got one of these messages said, well, you know, when I first thought it came from a number used mainly for distributing spam, and I thought it was some type of fraud. But then I realized I was wrong, and this is really true. But sending such messages through a service that usually sends spam was not the best idea. So on Thursday, Russians shared screenshots of text messages sent by the State Department with the offer of huge monetary rewards, up to $10 million, for information on hackers trying to interfere with our presidential election. Iranians were sent the same message to their cell phones, written in Russian and Farsi. Quote, the United States pays up to $10 million for any information on foreign interference in American elections. It includes a link to America's Rewards for Justice program, which offers cash bounties in return for information about threats to American national security. So, this is so disconnected, if not disingenuous, that an administration that has denied, and as I've said, based on the evidence, they are correct, there was no major Russian interference in 2016. That is a media and Democratic Party myth. But now we're offering $10 million to prove that what didn't happen last time may be happening right now. And get this, on July 13th, Mike Pompeo had a conference call with the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. And we're told that he rebuked the Russians for the claim that it paid bounties to Taliban fighters for the heads of Americans in Afghanistan. This gives new life to a story that is largely discredited. We have no evidence to show that this actually happened. There are no solid cases of Americans who were killed and bounties were actually paid. And it does appear that Russia has been supplying arms and cash to certain Taliban factions or units in Afghanistan. But it's a war. And we pay bounties all the time. We've got a bounty out for the legitimate leader of Venezuela right now. And all of this outrage that was ginned up that led to Liz Cheney sponsoring a bill the Democrats supported that ties the administration's hands to pull our troops out of Afghanistan. That was the ultimate outcome of this whole new Russia hoax that was launched in a feat of yellow journalism by the New York Times, which continues to stand by it, stoke it, promote it, and now this legitimizes it. I mean, this is the Twilight Zone. It defies rational description. So now, to piss China off even more, Trump has basically put up a fence around TikTok. And while it's not owned by the Chinese government, he sees this as a way to essentially take a platform that was developed in China, that is hugely popular, that competes with American social media platforms, and either shut it down based on unknown authorities claimed by the Trumpster, or force the sale to Microsoft or another American company with some sort of commission paid to the U.S. Treasury. I mean, that is an outrageous arrangement. It is international larceny. And China has a right to be pissed about this. While a lot of theories have been floated about how TikTok could be sharing your personal information, if you're a TikTok user, with the Chinese government, what the hell are they going to do with it? Are they going to come visit you in Peoria or Atlanta or a lovely seaside town in Maine? I mean, this is, to me, hysteria and a kind of Sinophobia that is used to drive Trump's campaign position that he's tougher on China than Biden is. Now, he also issued a second executive order of questionable validity to attempt to shut down the Chinese-based communications platform called WeChat. I've never seen WeChat, but the description is it's kind of a cross between Facebook Messenger, and it offers other services. You can pay your bills. I think you can send videos around if they're approved by the Chinese censors. But it is very popular beyond China, but is primarily used by people who are Chinese or communicating with Chinese citizens. So the Chinese Foreign Ministry correctly declared these actions as nakedly hegemonic. On the pretext of national security, the United States frequently abuses national power and unreasonably suppresses relevant enterprises. So these are remarkable, unprecedented moves. And I don't have a real stake in TikTok. You know, I've seen some of these videos. So some people are very clever the way they stage them. But it's like, you know, video with Twitter limitations, right? These are very brief. It's not like a half-hour long talk on YouTube or something like that. So we see that foreign policy is being corrupted to advance domestic political strategies. And we've got to be careful, because after Election Day, there will be payback. China doesn't take these things lightly, and I am not in any way rationalizing the obvious ills of the Chinese system. But they are a major player on the world stage today. They have nuclear weapons. They've expanded their navy. And I don't believe that they would directly engage in military action against the United States. They would use third parties. Oh, like Japan or South Korea. One more hit. The Trump administration today imposed sanctions on Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, and 10 other senior officials in Hong Kong and mainland China over the recent crackdown on political dissent in Hong Kong. Now, I don't know why Steve Mnuchin is the front man on so many issues for this administration now, but he was trotted out to say the United States stands with the people of Hong Kong and we will use our tools and authorities to target those undermining their autonomy. Now, I think there are legitimate positions for the United States to take in relation to Hong Kong and Xinjiang. That is the far western state of China where it is reported that as many as 1 million Muslim Uyghurs are locked up in re-education camps. But these diplomatic efforts, and, you know, I don't think sanctions really have much impact, but the effort to isolate China is not distinct from these politically driven moves like TikTok, WeChat. And we are poisoning the well in ways that, as I say, will linger well after Election Day. I would like to be reporting about major progress between Democrats and Republicans negotiating over renewing the $600 a week unemployment benefit, the other elements of a relief package that is way overdue in Washington. But there aren't any. Yesterday, Trump went to Ohio, and he unloaded on Joe Biden in a bizarre rant. He said that Biden is following a radical left agenda that will take away your guns, destroy your Second Amendment. No religion, no anything. Hurt the Bible, hurt God. He's against God, he's against guns, he's against energy, our kind of energy. Now, it's an irrational word salad. And there's hardly a factual basis for any of that. And to put God on the same level as guns, well, that might make sense to certain Americans. Biden pushed back. Trump's comments were shameful. Quote, like so many people, my faith has been the bedrock foundation of my life. It's provided me comfort in moments of loss and tragedy. It's kept me grounded and humbled in times of triumph and joy. And in this moment of darkness of our for our country, of pain, division, sickness for so many Americans, my faith has been a guiding light for me and a constant reminder of the fundamental dignity and humanity that God has bestowed upon all of us. For Trump to attack my faith is shameful. It's beneath the office he holds, and it's beneath the dignity the American people so rightly expect and deserve from their leaders. Okay, Joe. Trump is the one who should be criticized here. I have no judgment about the depth of Joe Biden's faith. I take him at his word. But this shows how desperate Trump is, just throwing out anything to minimize his opponent. And then, of course, Joe Biden hits the gaffe button and minimizes himself. So yesterday he made a comment. What you all know, but most people don't know, unlike the African-American community with notable exceptions, the Latino community is an incredibly diverse community with incredibly different attitudes about different things. Now, he was just babbling. And he got himself in a corner there, comparing brown people to black people. And as a white guy, that's a real dumb shit move to make. So, somebody tweeted on his behalf to try to clean it up. Earlier today, I made some comments about diversity in the African-American and Latino communities that I want to clarify. In no way did I mean to suggest the African-American community is a monolith, not by identity, not on issues, not at all. So today I'm releasing a fresh in-depth interview with a woman who was running for president. She is a psychologist, Dr. J.J. Walcott. She spent a few years working at the Pentagon, first under the Obama administration, later the Trump administration. She had some assignments related to NATO. She's a bright and articulate, interesting woman. But I posed a series of questions to her about the issues that I would use to define my alternative vote for president. I will not vote for Donald Trump, and I don't plan to vote for Joe Biden. I'm here in California, where Biden is going to carry the state unless he gaffes his way into oblivion. And it frees me to cast a protest vote once again. So I'm looking for a vehicle, and I asked Dr. Walcott to comment on renewing our Fourth Amendment rights and ending domestic surveillance. And what I found was she had earnest answers. but she really didn't take very strong positions. Here's an excerpt from that conversation.
Number one, recognizing that administrations that come into power have a lot more power than a lot of us realize. And simply because it is stated in the Constitution, much like any other legal document, there is interpretation, and then there are exceptions, and then there are leeways and timeframes, et cetera. And if there's anything I learned inside government, it's that we can work around just about anything with a justification. And I think that should concern everybody. I think that that is one of the major reasons I came out and started speaking, is because I had the opportunity to go across the department and started seeing different patterns, and this was one of them. So what you're seeing is really a result of the use of power to the extreme and around the intent of the rules. If I were to become president, that is something that would need to be stopped. Although we run into the problem of technology coming, and the technology is catching people doing anything, anywhere, all the time. And so even citizens, private citizens, are capturing information, and that makes the situation even harder. So we think we need to decide as a collective citizenry, what is it that we want the rules to be? Because what happened in the Constitution when it was written has changed dramatically because of technology advancements.
I invite you to listen to my full interview with Dr. J.J. Walcott, and we're blaming our friend Joe Carson in Knoxville, Tennessee, for this one. He emailed me a week or two ago and said he thought she'd be an interesting subject. The thing that I'll explain about the interview that I learned in the early moments of it is that I was laboring under the impression that she was still running. But she did bail out after visiting all 50 states because independent candidates cannot get on the ballot. And she explains that in the early moments of the interview. And like everything I do, this interview is made possible by the people who support my work with your subscriptions. People like Bill Halperin, Dave Derby, Marvin Rasmussen, and Siri Walgren, the original Siri. And if you're listening today, Siri, I hope you're doing better. She's had a tough time with some surgery, followed up by a reinfection that put her back in the hospital. And I hope that you are on the mend and back up to fighting speed, Siri. So a couple of boneheaded moves, again, regarding personnel in the Trump administration. Not only has he left massive numbers of positions unfilled, used acting appointees who never get submitted for Senate confirmation so that he can manipulate them, as they know they're on a very short leash. Well, the special envoy for Iran resigned, and so Trump reached deep to his bench and found the guy who was one of the people convicted for his role in the Iran-Contra affair. Now, Elliot Abrams, who worked the Iran side and the Contra side in the 1980s, has been assigned to bring down the duly elected government of Venezuela of Nicolas Maduro. Now his portfolio has been expanded to the Iran desk. So he's working on twin regime change in Tehran and in Caracas. This is a guy with blood on his hands and not much in his heart that I've been able to detect. So I guess the next scandal is going to be the Iran-Venezuela scam. So there's another appointee who was up on the Hill seeking confirmation today, and his name is Louis Bremer. He has been nominated to serve as Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Ops and Low-Intensity Conflict. You know, that's essentially managing all the mercenary projects. Lou Bremer, former Navy SEAL, investment banker, he is a managing director at Cerberus Capital. And they're the private equity company that owns the Safeway supermarket chain. But they also own a mercenary operation based in Arkansas called Tier 1 Group. The Tier 1 group has a contract to train some of the elite fighters who report to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman at the House of Saud. And in testimony driven by questions from Senator Tim Kaine, Bremer was asked if he knows if his company, Tier 1, trained the assassins who took out Jamal Khashoggi at the consulate of Saudi Arabia in Istanbul. That would be, what, 2 years ago in October? Well, Bremer had to check his memory. He was unfamiliar with an article that was cited at the hearing about Tier 1, and he said that neither Tier 1 nor Cerberus had investigated the allegation to his knowledge or recollection. I do know, Senator, that we train Saudi nationals as part of our engagements with the kingdom as an allied nation. We train other nations as well, but I have no knowledge of that. And Tim Kaine and the independent senator from Maine, Angus King, they followed up with jaw-dropping comments. They don't believe him. Do you? Meanwhile, MBS is being accused of trying to snuff out a former top intelligence official in Saudi Arabia. That is Saad al-Jabri, who's holed up in Canada, and he has filed a lawsuit saying that Saudi agents have tried to target him less than 2 weeks after the brutal assassination of Jamal Khashoggi. His suit has what is described as scant evidence to support its charges, and the New York Times says it cannot independently verify it. But I'd say his hunch is probably a pretty good one. And meanwhile, Democratic senators are trying to pass legislation with a little help from a few Republicans to put sharp limits on the export and sale of American military drones. And I believe this is a very dangerous type of commerce, and it once again relates to Saudi Arabia. This is the subject of the investigation by the State Department Inspectors General. One was fired, and his replacement just resigned this week, because it is alleged that Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, ignored restrictions and authorized the sale of arms, including some drones, to Saudi Arabia last year. And the idea that we should market these robotic weapons of war, basically create a world filled with military drones, that, my friends, is what I would call insane. Trump had a couple of setbacks in courts, one business, one personal, if you want to put it that way. A full panel of the very important U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit has ruled against the White House and said that the House of Representatives committees can subpoena the former White House counsel Don McGahn to testify before the Judiciary Committee. Now, this is a long-running struggle that undermined the effort to investigate and impeach Trump over the Ukraine scandal. And if Don McGahn had been permitted to testify, either there or at the impeachment hearings, we might have had a very different outcome. In a 7-2 decision, Judge Judith Rogers wrote that the committee had proved that it suffers a concrete and particularized injury when it cannot get information necessary to the legislative oversight and impeachment functions of the House. Indeed, she wrote, the ordinary and effective functioning of the legislative branch critically depends on the legislative prerogative to obtain information, and constitutional structure and historical practice support judicial enforcement of congressional subpoenas when necessary. But it won't go immediately to the Supreme Court. It's likely to be appealed by the Trump administration. But there are some other things that will be returned to a lower court to adjudicate first, so don't expect that subpoena to be honored anytime soon. Now, the personal setback for Trump, as you may know, he was flatly accused of rape by the writer E. Jean Carroll. She has a pretty credible account. of how she went to a famous New York department store and Trump came cruising into one of the dressing rooms. He recognized her. She's a bit of a celebrity in New York. And then she says he sexually assaulted her. So when Trump denied it and, tweeted false insults about her, she filed a defamation suit, and a New York judge has rejected Trump's claims of immunity and said that Ms. Carroll may continue with the case that she has brought. There were more demonstrations on the streets of Portland last night, but no tear gas and no federal goons, just state troopers and Portland police, who were once again defending the East Precinct. So the protest activity has moved from the Hatfield Courthouse downtown to some of these areas in other parts of the city. Now, they didn't call it a riot, but they called it an unlawful gathering. Soon after, 200 people converged outside a precinct. They lit a fire in a trash can. They splashed paint on the building. And this fund was sponsored by Pacific Northwest Youth Liberation Front. And the Portland Oregonian describes the back and forth. The police did use stun grenades and rock and roll smoke machines, and about a dozen people were arrested. One of the people arrested in Seattle, going back a bit to July 25th, is a woman named Samantha Six. Now, she was peacefully protesting when police in riot gear tackled and falsely arrested her and then dragged her, handcuffed, unconscious, and convulsing for half a block. She told the cops that she has a medical condition that leads to seizures. But they scoffed at that, and she was locked up for almost 24 hours, and they refused to give her any medications. She's now suing based on her claim, "I spent hours cuffed, locked up, and having seizures while police and jail guards walked past me and ignored me. I absolutely believed I was going to die." The Los Angeles Times today is reporting that a whistleblower from the LAPD's SWAT team has described what he calls a SWAT mafia. And this surfaced in the case of a homeless man named Anthony Soderbergh. And the report is that he had been, he unlawfully entered a home. He was initially packing a gun. He reportedly threatened a woman who lived in the home. But when the SWAT team showed up, including a chopper in the sky, L.A. loves their choppers, he ended up dead after 40 rounds were fired, including a dozen from the helicopter. And apparently that's the first time they've shot from a chopper. Now, the report indicates that at one point he fired some bullets at the chopper. But when he came out of the house after a protracted siege, his hands were up and he was unarmed. But the total of 40 rounds fired was enough to kill him dead. So this is something I applaud. Sergeant Tim Colomi, who's been on that SWAT team and is one of the negotiators, he has filed a civil lawsuit accusing a group of veteran officers known as the SWAT Mafia of creating a culture of violence in the unit that glorifies deadly force. Commanders, he says, turned a blind eye to the problems despite several years of his flagging them. Colomi has raised issues about three cases going back to 2018. And he says that the veteran officers who ran that mafia disregarded department rules governing the use of force, encouraged younger officers to do the same. He alleges the older guard used members of the unit who tried to de-escalate situations. I'm sorry, he said they called members of that unit who tried to de-escalate cowards and used nepotism to fill the unit with like-minded cops willing to kowtow to them. There are two other questionable deaths that occurred under the SWAT team that are also being raised in this lawsuit. And this is a turning point. When honorable cops stand up and expose the law-breaking, including deadly shootings, of their fellow officers, we actually have a prayer of reforming police in this country. Great commentary, and I've linked to it in the show file for today's podcast at peterbcollins.com by Trevor Tim over at The Guardian today. His opening line says it all. The Department of Homeland Security is a rogue intelligence agency that needs to be shut down. It's hard to reach any other conclusion, Tim says, on the heels of the DHS sending federal militarized police into Portland last month. He goes on to say that the intelligence gathering activities of DHS are out of bounds. He cites the reporting of Ken Klippenstein over at The Nation that Homeland Security has been gathering information on activists who the agency thinks are involved in the Antifa movement in an apparent attempt to tie them to foreign powers. An intelligence report leaked to The Nation included a readout of these individuals' personal information, social security number, home address, social media accounts. The attempt to tie activists to foreign powers is key, as it would open up even more invasive and warrantless surveillance methods available. And one quote from a source with knowledge of the surveillance operations: they targeted Americans like they're Al-Qaeda. And this includes the targeting of a Washington Post reporter and Ben Witties, the editor-in-chief of Lawfare. Each of them released classified documents that had been leaked to them. So this is an important statement. And I do agree that DHS is a rogue agency. It is too big. It's unmanageable. And it operates with some of the same secrecy as our foreign intelligence agencies. One more take from Trevor Tim's piece. Unfortunately, he says, some people in the Democratic leadership, especially House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff, have been placating and covering for intelligence agencies for the past 4 years, despite claiming that the Trump administration is a dire threat to the Republic. Schiff even went as far as killing bipartisan surveillance reform that could have protected immigrants and dreamers. And separately, NBC News reports that a couple of people fairly high up in Homeland Security have signaled that the top two acting individuals there, Chad Wolf, the acting secretary, Ken Cuccinelli, the acting deputy, are ignoring the input of career officials on key policies from immigrant enforcement to protest response. The part of the operation being ignored is the Office for Civil Liberties and Civil Rights. In recent months, that department has raised concerns about the development of a new use of force policy for Customs and Border Protection, including concerns about the use of chemical deterrents against people trying to damage the wall on the southern border. That is not surprising. Here's today's COVID-19 update, prepared by Linda Lewis. Our current stats show that 19.1 million cases have been confirmed worldwide, with total deaths reported at 716,000. Here in the United States, we're closing in on 5 million cases. It's 4.9 million today, and 160,000 deaths. That is more than 1,000 increase since yesterday. CNN reports that a new model predicts that 300,000 coronavirus deaths in the United States will occur by December 1st. If more Americans wear masks, that number could be reduced by as much as 70,000. Testing is down in 29 states with no perfect test available. Too many false negatives, according to Anne Rimwan, a professor at the UCLA Department of Epidemiology. She went on to say, testing needs to be expanding, not contracting. We really need to keep an eye on positivity rates. Many Americans live in diagnostic deserts and must wait weeks for results. The system is broken right now. You may have seen in social media the picture of that high school in Georgia, North Paulding High School, with this hallway packed with students. And you could see that most of them had their backpacks on, but very few were wearing face masks. And it turns out that the policy of the school is that they recommend face masks, but they're not required, and that social distancing will be employed as is feasible and practical. Some students who choose to wear masks are being bullied by their peers. And the student who was blamed for taking that picture in the hallway was suspended. And after an outcry from the public, the suspension was withdrawn. Now, as I mentioned, there has been no major progress on the next Washington bailout bill. But defense officials are demanding at least $10 billion for their pandemic-related costs. The Pentagon just got a huge increase. I believe it's $70 billion, including a chunk of money that is earmarked for the next war. But they're saying that, they need a hefty boost for defense spending. They need PPE. They need to be able to pay for logistics, for self-quarantining. It'll never stop. The call to spend more at the Pentagon never gets rejected. Yesterday, we reported that the governor of Ohio, who had planned to greet President Trump on his trip to Cleveburg, Mike DeWine, had to beg off because he was tested, and that test came back positive. Hours later, he returned to Columbus. They tested him again, and he tested negative. That's encouraging, isn't it? So he's going to be tested again on Saturday, and they'll take the best out of three, I guess. Well, Governor Cuomo of New York should be a hero in Trump's book, at least for a minute, because today he announced that schools across the state of New York can reopen for in-person instruction this fall. And that is contrary to almost every other jurisdiction that has had to grapple with the tough decisions about reopening schools. He says that schools can decide to open as long as they're in a region where the average rate of positive tests is below 5%. Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York, who often tussles with his Democratic superior, has said that schools can only open in the city if that rate is below 3%. But Cuomo's announcement doesn't guarantee that school buildings in 700 districts will all open up. It's now up to local politicians and superintendents to make a local decision, but he will not block them if that is their choice. And we have our first Willie Horton, an individual who was released from prison because of coronavirus concerns, is now accused of shooting his accuser. Ibrahim Bouyachi, age 33, had been indicted on charges of rape, strangulation, and abduction after Carla Dominguez, a native of Venezuela, told cops in Alexandria, Virginia, that he sexually assaulted her last October. Now, the suspect turned himself in 11 days later. A judge ordered him held without bond. And then, despite objections of an Alexandria prosecutor, lawyers for the man successfully argued on April 9th that he be released on bond, with a condition that he only leave his residence to meet with lawyers or pretrial services officials. Less than a month after his release, he was arrested May 8th for ramming a canine officer's vehicle. And the Commonwealth attorney told the Washington Post at that time, local authorities were not notified of the charges against him that he faced in Prince George's County. He had been on the lam until Wednesday when he was spotted in his car, and they found him with an apparently self-inflicted gunshot wound. And he is currently listed in critical condition at a local hospital in Virginia. Front page of the New York Times today says that we're number one. Headline, U.S. is alone among peers in failing to contain virus. Two major causes, individualist tradition and Trump administration missteps. And with a color graph showing 1.9 million cases in the past month, compared to the entirety of Europe with only 300,000 cases and other smaller countries listed as well. Yes, we are number one, and we are tired of winning. There's no doubt about it. And despite the risk, as many as 100,000 or even more motorcyclists are expected to converge in Sturgis, South Dakota. Many are already there for an annual event, and this is the 80th anniversary of this motorcycle rally. I used to have a motorcycle, and I like to ride. And there are all kinds of people who are not Hell's Angels or other crazies who happen to love motorcycles. But in Sturgis today, a worker at the event told a reporter that the crowd seems larger than in previous years. I've not seen one single person wearing a mask, said Jessica Christian, working at a bar. It's just pretty much the mentality that if I get it, I get it. She said, this is my third year. It's actually busier than previous years. People are basically treating it as a family vacation. Well, we'll see if there is a Sturgis surge down the road. And finally today, Facebook CEO and founder Mark Zuckerberg holds regular meetings with his employees. Yesterday, they did one of those, mostly online. And speaking at the all-hands meeting, he was asked to address the acquisition talks between TikTok and Microsoft. And Zuckerberg said he never comments on his company's merger and acquisition strategy, but he did say that the TikTok situation is an extraordinary circumstance. I just think it's a really bad long-term precedent, and that it needs to be handled with the utmost care and gravity, whatever the solution is. I am really worried. It could very well have long-term consequences in other countries around the world. Later he said, I certainly think there are valid national security questions about having an app that has a lot of people's data that follows the rules of another country, a government increasingly seen as a kind of competitor. And on another topic, he told employees that the increased use of mail-in ballots due to the pandemic will likely lead to a situation where election results will not be available for days or for weeks. He noted political figures and commentators may attempt to try to call an election early, in which case the company may label a post explaining that results are not yet final. And he didn't have a clear answer for what the company would do if Trump declared the election results invalid. Quote, this is where we're in unprecedented territory with the president saying some of the things that he's saying that I find quite troubling. We're thinking through what policy may be appropriate here. This is obviously going to be a sensitive thing to work through. Now, this occurred as one senior engineer at Facebook collected internal evidence that he says shows that Facebook has given preferential treatment to prominent conservative accounts to help them remove fact checks from their content. So he posted it on an internal site at Facebook. They basically have a Facebook for Facebook workers. And the company responded by removing his post, restricting internal access to the information that he cited. And the word is now that he was fired the very next day. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it absolutely everywhere. You'll find it on YouTube. Have a great weekend. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.